Order. And I would say, first of all, good afternoon, colleagues, and to those of you in the audience, we would welcome your attendance. We have an informational meeting today, a couple of subjects that I think we will find to be very, very revealing and very interesting. So with that introduction, we'll call up Bill Oddie from the Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Oddie. I'm the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Assessment and Evaluation. And we are here in response to a question, what are benchmarks? And we'll be directing our attention today. This first slide is one, for those of you good members, is where I ended up my last presentation. Because in order to explain what benchmarks are, we need to talk a little bit about how we've organized the academic standards in Oregon. And as you probably remember, I say we did this right in Oregon. We agreed on the content. What is it? We agreed to agree, and then we thought about it a lot, and then we came up with some agreements about what is it students should know and do, be able to do. Then we developed the assessments, reviewed the results, and set the performance standards. The contents are, the contents agreements are specified in several ways. The common curriculum goal, this is a hierarchical arrangement. And if you look to the next slide, we've got some definitions. The common curriculum goals describe the course of study. Essentially, what is it that we should teach to be a complete, effective curriculum for students in Oregon? And that we ask that that be used in all Oregon school districts. The content standards specify what is the students should be able to know and do. So that, first of all, we sort of have the teacher expectations and then the student expectations. The benchmarks are the checkpoints along the way. Right now, grades 3, 5, 8, and 10, in which the state checks in. The obviously assessment is ongoing. It is every year, it's every day, perhaps, in the classroom, as teachers are refining their instruction. But it is sufficient for the purposes of the state to check in at certain points. Now, I guess one bit of explanation in history is that we didn't make up the word benchmarks just to add one more thing to grades, because it seems like they're the same thing. The theory at the time was that the benchmark for development of the students might not be grade-based, so we wanted to look at developmental sequence in ways that could vary from grade. That was then, and this is now. There's been essentially an evolution in thinking about that, and partly in request from teachers, they want a more specific map. And so we started to do grade-level expectations, so clear expectations at each grade along the way as to what students should know. That also is in line with the new regulations that are No Child Left Behind, which require standards and assessments at each grade 3 through 8, and then at the high school, which is our SIN level benchmark. And one reason that there's probably a question about this is that the word benchmark is used commonly in a couple of ways. One is, the way we said it, is the point along the way at which we measure it. It's also used sort of informally to say what is it we expect of students at those points along the way. So we would properly say perhaps benchmark standards is what we expect of them, but it's often shortened just to be benchmarks. The development of standards is, at all levels, is heavily involved with the public, primarily teachers and district administrators and so forth, who interact with us, advise us, and review the standards. And we do that for the performance. Mardell will be talking about that development process in a little bit. Performance standards, as in how high, how much performance are we looking for to meet expectations, are also set publicly. We did this for reading and math in 1995, and actually it took some time before that. And what we did at that time was to set...
Excuse me. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil, I hate to interrupt you,
that's
but
right,
I think that's such an important point, and when asked that you elucidate a little bit on it, we often hear that it was such a top-down policy, and I particularly like the one where you mentioned the people that were involved. Could you talk about that a little more? I mean, the rooms full?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, there's two ways to think. If you went to an individual teacher, many of them may say, well, I wasn't asked. But if you look at the process we put through, there were hundreds of teachers who were involved, and we essentially gave folks opportunity to testify. It generally went through a board process for a review over a considerable period of time, at least a year in many cases. The technical side that we did was to bring in groups of teachers. There were also other citizens, subject matter experts, people with particular interest. And what we asked them to do was to look at these items, look at these content standards and the results that we got, and say, well, what is it that students should know to be successful? What's a successful third grader? What's a successful fifth grader? What should they be able to do? And we asked that question from a future perspective. You're asking about rooms full of people. So I'll come back to that part. So they put together their best judgment, and then that went out through the review process, where we said, all the teachers had given the assessments for a couple of years. We said, we're saying that, for example, on the math multiple choice test, 239 is a level of performance that is the standard to be set. And we said, what do you think about that? And the board had hearings about it. We did hearings around the state. So we gave sort of an open, and that's the way you have public testimony on issues that you're deciding. So that was the process for setting that standard. And it was done in 95, and we have held that constant. No Child Left Behind may cause us to go through that process again as we see whether, with adding new grade levels, we have to change the standards. But if we make any changes, it'll go through the same process of public review.
Bill, how long did that process take?
Mr. Chairman, my memory is that was about a year and a half of the setting of standards. Now, if you included the time in which we were administering tests, it was for years before that. But the time in which, again, I'm doing this primarily from memory of being in the school district watching this happen, that was about the time that happened. It took.
It might be maybe a speedier process when the No Child Left Behind kicks in.
We certainly intend to interpolate, and we know that fourth grade is going to be somewhere between third and fifth, so we're not quite starting from scratch.
Mm-hmm. But we do have a 30,000 question test bank, I understand.
Yes, so, Mr. Chair, we have a number of items, and we have to write more.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other thing I wanted to say about how we set the standards, again, was this future perspective. One way in which one could set a standard for performance on a test like this is to say, well, let's look at what kids did and take the 60th percentile. And say that's where we want to get everybody up to that point. So it's a sort of comparing to the current level of achievement. We didn't do that. We looked at what, given these tests and these content standards, where do we want third graders to be in the future? What will it take for them to be successful in their lives in the future? And that's, so we set high standards. We were setting standards that were, very ambitious and are still ambitious in terms of percent of students meeting. The blue sheet that you have in front of you wanted to give you a picture of what all this looks like. And this document, these are four pages from a document we use in test development called the test specifications. These are essentially the instructions, or part of the instructions we give to teachers who write our items, because we also have teachers writing the items. And what they see is that there are certain areas in which they have to construct items. There's a content standard, and then the benchmark for each level. I've chosen the SIM benchmark for all of these, but there are similar documents at the other benchmarks. Then there's just a further text explanation and an eligible content. The idea here is that of all the things that we set as expectations for students, not all of them are assessed on state tests. And if so there is a subset that we're sampling in our state tests, and that's what's eligible, that's what the tests are on. And then you can see the sample items. The first page front and back are from the reading test. The reading passages are missing. One of the things we've done is take real passages of text rather than sort of shorter composed for the purpose of tests, so they're published works. And then these are the kinds of questions that we ask on a 10th grade SIM test. Same thing for mathematics. So that gives you a sort of a picture of, at least at the level of content standards, SIM benchmarks, the content we're looking at, and the kinds of test items that are at that level. If you want more information about that, I'd direct you to the website. We have a PowerPoint presentation called The Life of an Item. It's a sort of a mini documentary, which we in assessment find very moving. Your taste may vary, but it does track through the creation. There's an extensive review process, which is another group of teachers and other citizens that make sure that the sensitivity, that there are no issues that be offensive to students, and then there's a match to the content standard, and then it goes into a test. And then at the end of its life, it retired to being a sample item. Any questions about the document that's there? The last thing I wanted to end on was to give you this sort of tool for thinking about how we've organized the assessment. We've said it's a three-legged stool, that to understand whether a student has met the standard, we want to look at use multiple choice tests, which are the best tests for efficiently getting at knowledge. Do they know the facts? Can they repeat them? We also have, at the state level, on-demand performance assessments, which are writing and math problem solving, for example. In writing, we write the prompt, and we send it out, and kids sit down, and they've got a certain amount of time to write their response to it. The third part of the stool that's important and I think is a strength in Oregon's is the classroom work samples, which is how well can students write or perform the information, the content standards, sort of in the context of their everyday work. And if you think about it, that's how we might value our own work or writing, in that we should know the facts behind it, but we should also be able to use it. And sometimes we have to use it on demand when it comes up in a situation, and other times it's evolved and we think about it and refine it, and it's very much in the context of our day-to-day work. So those three things, we say, adequately measure the student's achievement at a certain level.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All of us have heard numerous complaints, and I think some quite justified, in the amount of time that it takes to use this three-legged stool. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, Bill, if I'm not putting on the spot with something, but where are we on the automation or technology being used to facilitate making this quicker, easier, that kind of thing?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, the technology-enhanced student assessment, TESA, is a program that we are in the third year of, and we have focused primarily on the multiple choice tests, and we have working tests of all the benchmarks in reading and math, and we're starting with science this year. We're also looking at piloting the social science and a constructed response, which gets at some of the issues in work towards work samples. So I would say we have a working system. In other words, they administer a test, the tests are valid, and we use the results. We have about a third of our schools using TESA right now. We make that as an option for schools. And we're working to expand that as much as possible. We are not as far along as we'd like to in some other areas. For example, writing assessment. There is we know it's possible, and we started to pilot that the computer would essentially score the writing assessments. The student would enter, type in their responses, and the the technology exists to score them to our scoring guide and return results immediately. Obviously, we weren't going to trust the contractor's word on that, so we started a process where we had students do that method and then score them independently. We essentially funding cut off that part, so we're not as far along in terms of expanding the capabilities of the technology.
Representative?
Two follow-ups. Was that what you meant by constructed response? That was a new one to me.
Okay. Go ahead.
That was what you meant?
No.
Oh, it isn't. Then what is constructed response? I'm not familiar with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hudson, a constructed response is a term that may include performance assessment, but when we include it in knowledge and skills, we're talking about a very short answer. In other words, the student would type in two or three words, and we would score those on a much shorter scoring, simpler scoring guide than the full writing scoring guide. So it's a way to expand the kind of knowledge and skills we can get in a short format. It's somewhat in between the multiple choice and the on-demand performance assessment like writing in terms of its cost and difficulty to assess.
Okay. My second point.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then is it in your belief that within X number of years we will have the ability to score writing samples and work samples through technology to alleviate some of the burden on teachers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, yes, that is very much our intention. The very exciting opportunity is that if we can do that development, it would not have to be just for the state tests. There are states. Texas, I believe, is making this available to teachers as they need it in their classroom, and that would allow for the scoring to be done online. The mathematics math problem solving is also, we believe, possible. It would involve manipulating graphs and charts on the screen and essentially creating whole new types of items. So we know that's out there, and we just haven't gotten as far as we'd like in developing it. And, yes, I believe that is all I have to say, and I'll let Mardale go from there.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mardale Dunsworth, the Director of the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services. And as Bill and I were talking about this presentation, we thought you might want to know a little bit more about the communications around standards. We wanted you to know how other Oregonians have also participated in this review process. And as Bill mentioned before, in 1995-96, we had over 1,500 Oregonians participate in the design process. But ongoing, we have content panels meeting every year around every content area. So we have over 200 teachers a year that help us in the design and review of content standards and assessments. We also work with expert review panels. And as Bill mentioned, we have public input sessions when we go through a revision process. We have feedback questionnaires that we've mailed to all schools when we just designed the new English Language Arts standards, which you have in your packet. Actually going out tomorrow, it's post-dated or predated for tomorrow's mailing, so you get it hot off the press, as well as the new 4 SIM English Language Arts standards that are ready to go out. So we had... we actually went through about a 2-year process of review and revision of these English Language Arts standards, which included those feedback questionnaires and teleconferencing, as well as multiple state board reviews. Another communication tool that we have is the standards newspaper, and you have a copy of that in your packet as well. This has been sent out to every teacher in the state since 1997, and I'll walk you through it just a little bit. I'm sure you've probably seen it, but it's probably our most distributed communication tool around the standards. We generally want to have articles that are current information that teachers will want to have in their hands the minute they get this newspaper. So you'll see some information around comprehensive assessment tools in the articles. You'll also see information around the timeline for the Certificate of Initial Mastery, the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, and then the SIM implementation timeline, and then how we will be going through a continuous review process of the standards is on page 6. from page 7 forward, you'll see all of the content standards as they're currently being assessed in classrooms. As you get to the center of the newspaper, you'll see a pull-out section that are the web resources. So what do we do at the department to support teachers in the implementation of standards? This we can just take all around the state as a one-piece document and refer folks to all of our resources. But you'll also see in the center the upcoming standards. So last year we adopted new mathematics standards. We want to give schools and teachers at least 2 years prior knowledge before the students begin being assessed on those standards. So they have these 2 years ahead of time, and those are the teal pages in the center. Okay, and then you'll see at the end of the newspaper the performance standards and then the contact information for people at the Department of Education. We also post all of our standards and assessment documents on the department's website, and we've published a teaching and learning standards document for each content area since 1997. Our most recent endeavor is the teaching and learning web space, and we're very excited about this. We have all of the content standards loaded on our web space, and what we're doing is finding instructional objects, diagnostic assessment, skill checks, and content background for every single standard. And right now we've got 3 of the mathematics strands loaded, and teachers have been using them for about the last 6 months. We started with algebraic relationships, and we're moving along the 5 content strands, or the 5 strands of mathematics. We expect to have mathematics done within the next 2 months, and then we'll begin loading all of the English language arts tools that will support teachers in the classroom to implement the brand new standards that have just been adopted. We also wanted to share with you the resources at the department to support standards and assessments. We have 9 education specialists that work on alignment of assessments and curriculum issues. We have 17 that work on test design and test production, and we have 8.5 FTE that work that are technical personnel that work mostly on the assessment side of the work. These education specialists work on model curriculum and instructional strategies. They're sort of our outreach to the field. They're available for teachers to talk to about their content area and in working on school improvement and database decision making. And then the last slide that I wanted to share was something that I'm sure that you all know, but the public support of standards and is very strong, and we continue to get feedback that a standards-based system is important to teachers and important to our parents. With that, I think our presentation is complete, and we'll take any questions you may have.
Representative Hobson.
This may be early to ask. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What work is in process to coordinate this with No Child Left Behind so that we're not being duplicative or anything like that?
Should I start with that, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson? The No Child Left Behind is very compatible with where we've been in Oregon. The fundamental premise of No Child Left Behind is set as a state your content standards and then create assessments related to those content standards, and then report the results of how many students have met those. And if we think about what we've been talking about in terms of the state, that's what we've been doing. So we have the content and assessments in reading and math and science. Reading and math were already approved prior under the previous reauthorization of the ESEA. So that system was all in place and approved. The requirement of No Child Left Behind adds the tests, as I said earlier, at grade 4, 6, and 7. There are some additional tests that need to be done in terms of English language proficiency. There's new reporting category requirements and disaggregation of data requirements. So we have quite a bit to do to meet the use of data and the reporting issues, but fundamentally at the level of content standards and assessments, we are right in line. And to say that again, the No Child Left Behind does not set a national curriculum or a national test. As a matter of fact, it essentially prohibits it in that the states are directed to do their own content standards and assessments to those content standards.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be fair to say then, Bill, if we were to throw out the standards and the assessment that we currently have in place, that we would just have to reinvent them again to meet the federal mandates of No Child Left Behind?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hudson, yes, that would be a fair characterization of what we'd have to do, because we have the work we have been doing over the last 10 years to get to this point would have to start over and be done this year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bakken.
Are there any recommendations you would make that would make it easier for you to do your job or to implement the SIMCAM that still keep us in compliance with No Child Left Behind?
Anything come to your mind?
Well, I was thinking, Representative Savaki and Mr. Chair, I was thinking about Bill's response, and we're really ahead of the game. When No Child Left Behind was written, we already had our math standards, grade-level standards, adopted. We had our K-3 English Language Arts standards adopted, and just now finished with 412, so we really are ahead of the game. We're really in a great position.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bakken, I think this committee and the legislature generally are on the path that will help us, which is to clarify what it is we mean by the SIM, what parts of it do we value, what don't we value. Right now there's a great deal of uncertainty in the field about what this all is, what it costs, and so I think if we came out at the end knowing those things and having a clear statement of purpose and of value for this, that would make the job easier.
Thank you.
Well, very good. Thank you for your testimony and for appearing before the committee.
You're welcome.
Committee, our next speakers are not here at this time, so I think we'll just stand at ease for a few minutes. Jim, are we talking in terms of like at 2 o'clock?
That was the anticipated arrival time at 2 o'clock.
So we aim for 2 o'clock then? And okay, so we'll stand at ease. Tag team, would you come up together? Very good. Come up, please.
Okay. East and west, right?
Right.
He gets the mix.
Sit next to the extension cord.
What was the order before? I was first? Okay. I am Jim Scherzinger, superintendent at Portland Public Schools, and I do have a handout that, so you don't have to keep notes, because I think I just kind of laid out what I'm going to say. We were asked to talk about accountability when it comes to schools. And this is a conversation we had with the House Revenue Committee a few weeks ago. And we talked about revenue in there, but I won't talk about money at all, or very little about money, and certainly not about revenue today. We'll just talk about the notion of accountability. And there are really two kinds, as I think of it. One is around achievement issues. You know, schools are accountable for the achievement of its students, and cost, accountable for how we spend our money. I want to separate the two. First, talk about achievement. I think the first thing to recognize is that when you and I went to school, that the goal of education was different than it is today. When I went to school, the goal of education was to offer the best curriculum that the district could, and to sort the students out. You know, if Jerry got it, he got an A. If I didn't get it, I got an F. And it wasn't the responsibility of the school district to be sure that I learned. If I got an F, I got an F, and that was my responsibility, maybe my parents' responsibility, but not the school district's. Under No Child Left Behind, under state school reform, and under Portland's strategic plan, our own district's strategic plan, which is that all kids achieve, the fundamental difference is the school is now accountable for the success of its students. When you say no child left behind, that's what you mean. The school district can leave no child behind. Every student has to succeed. We're accountable for that success. And there are reasons for this. I think we have to recognize that. One of them is that in a modern economy, there are not places for people to go that don't reach a certain standard of education. And that's different from even when I went to school. And secondly, I think we have to recognize that the education system has always failed some students. In fact, if you look at any sort of graph of achievement, whether it's graduation or test scores, where they're testing the same population, that achievement in schools in general have risen over the years. So we've always failed some students. It's just that now we care more and we say, or we have reason to care more, that all students achieve. And in particular, we've always failed some kinds of students. We've failed low-income students disproportionately, and we've failed minority students disproportionately. We have not achieved at the same level as other students. And so the change today is that school districts are accountable for the achievement of all its students, and especially for those students that's traditionally failed. So the question is, if that's the case, what does that mean? What does it mean to hold a school district or a school or even a state accountable for achievement? And I think what it boils down to is three things. In order to hold somebody accountable, you first have to set what the expectations are. What are the standards that you're going to hold somebody accountable to? Secondly, you have to be able to measure performance against those standards. And thirdly, you have to establish some sort of consequences or rewards or incentives based on that performance, at least recognition. Maybe that's all the incentive you need, recognition that you're succeeding against the standards or performing against the standards. But if you're going to hold somebody accountable, you have to do those things. So, now, you can have quite a debate about each of one of these elements. What are the standards that we agree that schools ought to meet? What is the measurement device that we're going to use to judge whether we meet those standards or not? Or what are the consequences or the rewards for failure or success? But I think the first question is really, do you agree with that goal? And in my conversation with people, not necessarily everyone agrees with that goal. Not necessarily everyone agrees that a school should be responsible for a student's failure to learn. And now, I would say my board uniformly agrees that we ought to be, and that we ought to be accountable for all kids achieving. That's why we have the strategic plan we do, and I agree with that. And I agree we failed kids in the past that should succeed. But I don't think everybody necessarily agrees with that, and that sometimes when you get in this debate about SIM and CAM, what really is underneath it with some people is disagreement with that fundamental goal. So I think the first thing is, do you agree with the goal or not? Because if you don't agree with the goal, I don't see how, you know, you go down the next steps to talk about the rest of it if you don't agree fundamentally with the goal to begin with. If you do agree, and if you do disagree with a goal, and if the legislature disagreed with that goal, they've got a big fight with the federal government that they ought to be doing, if that's where you are. Because the federal government essentially has put a mandate on every student in every school in the state that by 2014, I think it is, that every one of those students have to reach a standard. And that's a mandate on every kid in the system. And if you don't agree with that goal, then you've got to fight with them. If you do agree with the goal, then I think the question is, how do you then align all the existing mandates that the state imposes on schools to that goal? Do we have mandates out there that don't align with the goal? Well, then they ought to be changed to bring in a whole alignment. You have to set standards. What are the standards that you want every student to meet? You have to get the best measurement against those standards that you can afford. And you have to organize the Department of Education, just like school districts have to organize themselves around the goal, and you have to have some mechanism of reporting those results and whatever consequences come from them. And again, to be clear, I believe the Portland School Board agrees with the goal. Certainly all the core team participants in our strategic plan agreed with that goal. And so we'd be very supportive of the kinds of things that you have to do to implement this kind of goal statewide. Now, I guess the question then becomes, given that I accept, and perhaps you accept, that is our goal, where do we stand on accountability for achievement? Well, I think we have widely acclaimed standards in this state. I don't know that we have significant disagreement about what kids ought to learn. And that in most things that I read across the country, the standards that have been set for what each kid ought to learn at each grade level are fairly widely acclaimed. We do have quite a debate about tests and what are the most appropriate tests. And the only thing I'd say about, well, I have three things to say about that. One is that if you want accountability, you have to have some measure. You can't just say, get rid of the test, because then you have no measure by which you can hold me or anyone else accountable. And if you get rid of the measure, we're just going to have to come up with our own measures if we're going to be accountable to our school board or to someone or to our public about whether we achieve or not. And the odd thing is if multiple choice tests in particular are inadequate measures, which many people argue they are, and which in a lot of cases I might agree with, the better measures are going to cost more money, not less. So to some extent, this question about what tests are appropriate is an economic question. You get the best test that you can afford, but recognize when they're inadequate, they're inadequate. And I think a pretty good case could be made, for example, and this is what I hear. I came from the finance side of things, but as I hear talking to a lot of my instruction people, they would say that the science test is perhaps a better measure of reading than it is a measure of science. And maybe you need a different kind of test to really measure knowledge of science. And that any sort of measure of social studies is a difficult one, and multiple choice tests are perhaps totally inadequate. But in any event, it's to put it into context, is that if you want somebody to be accountable for it, there's got to be a measure. And the question is, what is the appropriate measure? I think that not all the state mandates that are out there are aligned to the goal. Not all the mandates that are on school districts are necessarily been thought through with regard to what the goal is. And I think the Department of Education, and I know the current superintendent knows this and is working on this, historically has been a compliance agency. And that's a very different thing from being a goal-driven agency. And so I think there are efforts taking place to try to move them as well as to move school districts. And then lastly, I'd say if our funding is lacking, then you have to set priorities. You have to say which of these mandates or which of these if we're not giving up on the goal, which I don't believe we should, is there a way to set priorities among in terms of our timeline for achieving the goals? Understanding that the federal government has set some pretty aggressive timelines as it is. But I think that's what to me is the appropriate debate, is about what those priorities are, understanding that this is the goal we're trying to achieve. So that's very quickly my sense on achievement. I think Jerry will have some things to say as well. I have some very brief things on costs, and the things that I would recognize there is that to recognize that the state collects a lot of data on costs. I don't believe that our problem is lack of data. I believe that if we have a problem, is that we don't effectively use or analyze all the data we have. I know historically, certainly when I was working in the legislative process, that, and we didn't have as good a data as we have today, that we really struggled in having resources to analyze the data. And I think we still struggle with that. There were two studies done over the interim that now there is one person in the Department of Education whose really job it is to analyze this data. And we've got some good examples of the kind of analysis that we can get. And we need a lot more analysis of the data we have, given the amount of money that we spend on education in the state. One of the things that I did in the past, and I'd like to do this again, I haven't had a chance to do that, is that I ranked all the school districts in Oregon with all the state agencies in terms of how much general fund and lottery money goes into them. And if you were to do that, you would find that school districts like Salem and Portland are among the largest state agencies, that you spend as much general fund money and lottery money on Portland Public Schools as you do most state, as I think we were like sixth largest or something like that. But the amount of money that you spend or the amount of resources you spend on really analyzing how we actually spend that money is nowhere near the amount of resources you devote to even much smaller agencies than that. And now, I know our lobbyists get upset about this because they talk about local control. But I firmly believe that if there were greater understanding of how we spent our money, and that people would have a different attitude about school funding. Now, I think it has to be more than that. Money is only a piece of it. I think what I know to be true is that when we get business people to go out and be principal for a day in a school and they see how a school really operates today, they come away transformed in ways that they never expected. And we get a lot of supporters in Portland Public Schools from that kind of process. So I think it's both things. You have to see what's happening in schools today, and you have to understand how we spend our money and how we set priorities to get to the point where you're willing, as a citizen, as a business person, as a legislator, to make the kind of investments that I know we need to make in the school system today. And then lastly, in terms of specific cost items, you know some of these. PERS reform is a huge thing for Portland Public Schools. You know, our increase in cost is $13 million from the increase in the rate on PERS this year. PERS reform is a huge cost item for us. Control of health care costs is another huge cost item. School districts spend 85% of their budget on personnel, salaries and benefits of personnel. And so the health care and PERS costs are huge in our budget. And then lastly, the last thing, and this perhaps that has not gotten as wide a play, but I think it's still important cost saver for schools, is moving towards statewide student information and finance systems. One of the things we've done in Portland Public Schools this year is partnered with the ESD, all the other districts in Multnomah County, with Eugene School District, and now Beaverton and also Beaverton and Bend are coming into the same system, a new student information system. If every district in the state, you follow the same student information system as well as the state, there would be huge cost savings to school districts. Now, we've even co-located within Multnomah County so that if a student moves from David Douglas to Portland, the record never moves. It's on the same computer system. The only thing that changes is the permission of who gets to look at it. And there are significant cost savings, and I think all of our IT directors, virtually all of them in the state now, agree there's significant cost savings from getting statewide student information and financial systems, not only in terms of just paying for the system itself, but when changes need to be made, when records need to be shifted, the savings you get from not having to translate them every time, not translate in the sense of Spanish or but translate in the sense of different computer systems and how they read the data, the savings there are significant. So that's the last thing on cost. I'd be glad to address any questions. Maybe you want to have Jerry go first and beat us both up after that.
Okay, Jerry, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My comments are at your place, and what I'm going to do is back up a little bit from what Jim was talking about, but probably hit a lot of the same themes. Both of us served on the Revenue Options, School Funding, and Accountability Task Force and offered some guidance to the Advisory Council. And the last time we spoke together, we were talking about that some, and I wanted to begin my comments with some reflection on that particular experience. Because for me, I'm relatively new to the state. This is my third year in Oregon as a superintendent. I've served as a superintendent in another state for 6 years prior to that. I really appreciated the diversity of viewpoints that were represented on the task force, and that helped me better appreciate also some of the issues that Jim was talking about regarding accountability. Not only was it a rich talent pool, but the viewpoints represented, I think, the diversity of business, industry, schools, higher education, the retired community, and we also had legislative input in our group. And so as we looked at different issues and thought about them together, I wouldn't say that in any way that we reached any level of consensus, but I continually heard that not everyone believed that additional revenues were needed without more accountability. And I think the educators in the group felt as if there was plenty of accountability and more accountability was on the way. with NCLB or No Child Left Behind. All of us, though, seem to agree that the achievements of Oregon students right now are overclouded or clouded by the fact that we have this uncertainty over issues of funding. Next, I'd like to talk a little bit about the legislative focus, or what this means to me as a superintendent relative to what your responsibilities are as legislators. I think our committee felt it was extremely important, as Jim mentioned, that somehow the legislature come to grips with an improved understanding of how the educational resources are expended. It's important that you help us restore public confidence in our public education system. And as I've listened to the debates in the last several months, I think that we have to appreciate that there's been a real change of power focus in education. When we think about control of our schools, when I talk to my local board, I often refer to the legislature, because you, in essence, control the purse strings of our schools. And it's based upon the decisions that come from Salem regarding our revenues that we can move forward with decisions. Today I was asked the question, well, what are we going to do now that ballot measure 28 didn't pass? And I had to say to the reporter, well, we will wait until the legislature starts making some action or starts looking at some bills relative to the revenue picture, because without that, we only have what the governor's proposed budget is. And so one of the things that we talked about in the committee was the difficulty that we have as school superintendents in planning our budgets with our boards and with our communities. And I'm pleased to see the progress that the legislature is making so far this year. And I'm encouraged by that progress. And I encourage you to continue that, move forward, so that we can have a clear picture of what our revenue stream might be, regardless of what it is. We need to know so we can do our planning. Which leads me to the next question, then. What does it mean to have stable and adequate funding? This seemed to be one of the questions our committee talked about a lot, and I'm sure you're talking about it a lot here, but I'd surely like to know what we mean by these terms. It seems as if everyone has their own definition of what we mean by these terms, and I think it's imperative that we come to some common agreement of what those individual terms really relate to. Because here you have a study of contrasts. Some of you probably know where Hermiston is. I drove about 280 some miles today. I think it was that. It starts blurring together. It's about, if you don't know where Hermiston is, we're on the Columbia River, about 180 miles from Portland. And we're in the eastern side of the state. We have 4,200 students. We're a growing district. We're not growing in leaps and bounds, but we're growing by 2 to 3% a year. In the game of school funding, that's a very healthy growth rate, and many people would like to have that. Because what it allows you to do is deal with some of the problems of stagnant funding differently than how others deal with these same problems. And I think those of, while we can compare our districts relative to urban and rural and the differences there, the key factor for us is the fact that we are a growth district. In our committee, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about the quality ed model, but I think when we talk about a legislative focus, I think that's extremely important from my point of view as a superintendent, and I think what we were talking about in our committee. Which leads me into a discussion on the issue of local versus state control. Having said that there's many issues that you deal with regarding education in Salem, I think it's very difficult to run the schools from Salem. And I'm not thinking that any of you really are seeking that role, but there is that confusion and there's tension in the system presently, is all I'm really saying. I think you have plenty of things to look at. One is the quality ed model. You have state assessment results. Jim referred to the information from our financial systems relative to the database initiative. We have state standards, as Jim mentioned. We have a school report card. And we also have connections with high-speed internet, which allows us to look at this information rapidly. And I look at all those things, and I think to myself, it's strange that people don't think we have accountability. I think in this whole arena, though, of the difference between local and state control, I would hope that in an era where fiscal constraint is necessary, that we must ensure that if there are any new programs, that they're carefully costed out, and that we have no additional new mandates. We need your support also to restore the third grade writing, the fifth grade writing assessments, and the problem solving at fifth and eighth grade. And I'd also ask for the science assessment test to be restored. Which will lead me into my next comments. Why would I want that? It's much more expensive for us to produce quality assessments at the local level, especially with a district our size, even with the help of ESDs. Whether it's a performance assessment, which would be a writing assessment or problem solving, the reliability and validity of those tools, we simply can't match it, what's being done at the statewide level. And these pressures are mounting. The pressures for accountability are mounting through the No Child Left Behind, and that leads me into my next point of federal versus state control. As Jim said, I think we have some basic decisions to make, and I thought he framed the argument very well in terms of where you start with. In our case, though, it's important to remember how much resource is being directed to our schools by the federal government. The figure I have written is 8%. It varies from district to district, but I think that's a fair number to use in Oregon. We know that the special education and the No Child Left Behind mandates far exceed their revenue reach. Probably the best example is in the area of special education. Presently in Congress, they are looking at requests by superintendents, school districts, school boards to meet but what they said they would offer schools, the 40% back in 1976 when these mandates first came into place. We've seen lots of changes in the law, and most studies would indicate we're getting between 14 to 18% of the cost of special education from the federal government. So there's a big gap between what the promise was and what we're receiving. That's my concern also with No Child Left Behind, is that presently we're seeing flat funding from the federal government at best.
Any thoughts on what that might be?
Does sound like fire drill. I thought I recognized that.
We'll be excused for the fire drill.
I was talking to some about the federal and state control issues and about resources. Jim mentioned the issues relative to testing. I think as you look at the work that's in front of you this year and thinking about issues relative to testing and trying to factor in the components of No Child Left Behind, I think what it all boils down to from our perspective is there's a lot more accountability. We don't see the accountability going away. In fact, there's different pressures of accountability than we've ever had before. So when we turn our attention to the issues of the SIM and the CAM, when we've tried to cost these out, and I believe you'll be getting some data from COSA potentially later this week, what we found is in our district these reforms are deeply ingrained. I talked to the principal and analyzed this, and I didn't see that we would see any great savings. Over time, there might be savings, but it's important to realize that we've been working on this for over 8-9 years. And so consequently, the system has changed so that it is now currently built around those reforms. Our committee did talk about, and I know that others support the idea, that there may be a need to simplify this some. And I think there's some support for that. But the requirement then would potentially be limited to areas like language arts, math, and science. As Jim mentioned, social studies is a difficult area to assess, and perhaps it's not as important to have a high-stakes test in that area. I wrote down here, we've been experimenting with an electronic management system, and I'm not certain if it's the same one they're using in Multnomah County or not, but I do believe the idea of a common student information system is extremely powerful. And there are tremendous gains that could be reaped if we looked at that as a state. In the area of the SIM and the CAM, though, this electronic management system, we're finding, will probably give us better communication with parents about how students are progressing with work samples. Currently, it is simply in a folder. And we're transforming that to an electronic environment where, like with our grades, they are available to parents immediately. And I noticed, I was looking in the, I think it was the Salem paper this morning, they were reporting how in Medford, all of a sudden, parents can have access to grades and attendance. Well, that's what a good student information management package will provide you. And I think we could do the same with the SIM and the CAM. And I think my point would be the same as what I heard Jim saying. If we don't stay the course, what will take its place? This is a well-designed system. We've invested many dollars in it. People are familiar with it. I believe that Oregon has one of the best assessment systems in the country. And there's a balance in the assessment system that we currently have. We have to do an awful lot with teaching phonics to students. 30% of our students are Hispanic in Hermiston, and we have quite a large ESL population and migrant population. So it's extremely important that we stress phonics. When we do that, we have writing measures then to make sure that we're hitting all the areas of literacy. And that's the balance, that if we take away the performance measure, we're likely to get an unbalanced approach to assessment. Our committee also talked about issues relative to the local option. And we were talking and striking out and thinking about different ways that we might improve the revenue picture. We talked about defining a means to allow districts to ask voters to extend their property tax beyond the Measure 5 limits, realizing that that would also require a system of equalization so that inequities don't creep into that system. We felt that that might benefit districts in two ways, not only from the revenue side, but also getting a closer connect with their communities. We also had the suggestion that perhaps a statewide property tax ought to be introduced across the state that would equally benefit all districts and education in general. Recently, there's been quite a discussion about the issue of equity, and I thought I would attempt to talk about that some. Clearly, in Hermiston School District, we have benefited from all children having equal access to the resources of the state. And I think while there are concerns about the effects of equity, which may lead us to re-examine the formula and some of its components, as suggested by the recent Oregon Department of Education report, the next challenge is really adequacy. And the issue of equity, in my opinion, is frequently whose ox gets gored. But when we talk about equity, it's ensuring that all children have the benefit to the resources from the state that they need to be properly educated. This is one where our advisory council didn't spend a lot of time. It tends to polarize people a lot. And part of the reason why it does is it appears then that there's a never-ending drain on state resources. And I think that's one of the issues with the quality ed model. We look at that model and we say, this would give us adequacy. This would help us achieve the standards, and it would allow us to deal with different populations and tie that to performance levels. I think we each have our own story about what the effects are of declining revenues. Certainly PERS, health costs, and contracts squeeze our resources.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, Representative Vakian.
Before you move on to that, I wasn't clear on whether you thought the local option created an inequity. And if it does, what you think needs to be done in order to combat that?
I think it has the potential to create an inequity. And I think in order to combat that, potentially a system ought to be in place similar to what we have with the local option, where it is equalized up to a certain level. I think the level chosen was 75%, the 75% average. And I think there was a bill introduced and passed in the last legislative session that did that. But at the same time, I would want to differentiate that the type of local option I'm referring to would be a different form of local option that wouldn't rely upon the compression and the tax formula as it is, as it currently exists. And part of the rationale for that is it's very difficult to explain, and it varies a great deal from community to community what is available there.
Please continue.
Okay. In our committee, we looked at what the effects were of taxation, and it was impressed upon us that our state's ranking is about 47 in relationship to other states in regards to the overall level of tax burden. And that was something that was difficult for our committee to comprehend, as well as when we understood it. When you balance these two things, if we have service levels that are achieving outstanding accomplishments, how it is the case that these two things are in balance? I guess finally, I would wrap up by saying, in the short 3 years that I've been here, I'm very proud to be an Oregon educator. I think we have an outstanding system. And I believe that it's important that we celebrate elements of our system and some of our results. We have a declining dropout rate. We have improved test scores. We have high SAT scores. I personally chose Oregon because of the curricular reforms here. My background is in curriculum instruction. I have a PhD in that area. And so in that regard, I'm somewhat an unusual superintendent. But at the same time, that was important to me. And I believe we have a quality system. I think we have to find the means to support it.
Thank you very much. Representative Farr.
Thank you. Superintendent, our state's ranking of 47 with regards to the overall level of tax burden. Can you explain that?
Some others would probably explain it a lot better than I.
Actually, I thought it was 46, but okay. we can quibble about that. If you take the total state and local tax dollar amount collected in the state of Oregon from both state and local government and divide it by the personal income of the state, which is the most common way of comparing tax burdens, that we would have, I think our percentage is about 10%. That is below the U.S. average and ranks us about 46th in the country, or sixth lowest in effect. And I understand that data is about, the data itself has 2 to 3 year time lags in it in terms of the collection of it. My understanding is there's the newest one that was out, which is 2 years old, that the ranking has moved up a bit. But if you were to then take the most current data and calculate Oregon's number that would go in, that it's going to drop again when you get, because of the huge drop in revenue we've had in the last 2 years, that we would probably drop very substantially in the rankings that will then come out years hence. There's always a 2 to 3 year time lag in the data.
I have a question for either one of you gentlemen. The subject is portfolios. Now we know that they're optional by schools, I guess, not even by school district necessarily, but by schools. We're hearing a lot of comment about portfolios taking a lot of teachers' time. Perhaps they're not being used as was intended, and so teachers are frustrated with them. Some are, anyway, with the amount of time they have to use to develop those or keep those. Any comments?
I'd be happy to comment on portfolios, Mr. Chairman. I think the the system of a portfolio is simply a collection of evidence. And so if we were talking about writing, a writing teacher might keep a portfolio of writing samples that a student has had or written in for several years. And each individual school district approaches that differently depending upon what they value. So we have discussions about what stays in the portfolio. And if you take a portfolio from the middle school to the high school, what would stay in the portfolio? Well, what we would keep in the portfolio might be a piece that would benchmark or meet the standard for a SIM. That's what we would retain in a portfolio. The management of portfolios is difficult, and it is time-consuming. I would say that, yes, that is a factor here, and that the management of paperwork is what people are dealing with. The issue, though, of assessing writing and giving students good feedback on it and collecting best pieces is really considered a best practice in the area of writing. It's probably not been as much a best practice in the area of mathematics, but this has helped bring that along. And so by collecting best practices or best evidence pieces in that area, I think we've extended the study of mathematics into other areas than we otherwise might not have.
To me, it goes back to the... I think basically I agree with Jerry. I think that it goes back to the question of assessments and how you do assessments and what are the quality of those assessments, which becomes a question, first of all, why are you doing them in the first place? And are you doing them to assess where a student is in their progress and to give feedback to the student and to parents about where a student is and what they've achieved? Or is it something that you're doing with respect to trying to make a judgment about the school or about the quality of the school or the school district? That's the sort of first question, is being clear about why you're doing it. And then secondly, how integrated it is into the program. That's just the normal program of what you're doing, how good the systems are for managing it. Some kinds of systems, information systems, might better manage it than others. And so all of those things come up. But clearly, the better quality of a measure you have, for whatever purpose you have it, to some extent, the more expensive it's going to be. And if it's a lot of work, you have to make that, which it is, you have to make some trade. You have to be, and your funding is restricted, you have to make some judgment about the relative worth of this investment versus some other investment that you're making. And which I think is essentially what Jerry said. Yeah.
Yes, Representative Vakian.
Thank you. After a student completes a piece of work that eventually will go to the portfolio, and that piece of work is graded or assessed in some other way by the teacher, and then it moves to the portfolio, what other role does it have in the assessment of the student? After it's sitting there in the portfolio itself.
Representative, I think what the chief role that piece plays is to see whether you can get a better piece. You have to have samples in certain areas if we're talking about writing. So a student would need to produce a narrative piece, a story, expository piece, a persuasive piece. And then they would be looking towards improving on their last assessment in keeping that piece in the portfolio. So that's why it's important to have that in the portfolio. What we are struggling with, if we have an electronic management system then, would be, is it important to keep the piece itself in the portfolio? Instruction, from an assessment side or point of view altogether, that's all it's there for. Instructionally, though, if we use those pieces in different ways, teachers are probably in our systems using them differently depending upon their teaching styles. They may use them with students in other ways. So it could have other values too.
If you think about it more generally and think back to the goal is that all kids achieve. And part of the change that requires of schools is they have to have, as that's the purpose of assessment, any kind of assessment you do, is that a teacher has to know what each child knows before and what each child doesn't know, and to some extent what the learning style of that child is, to help each child achieve. And so part of the goal of any assessment is to inform the teacher about what a child knows so that you know what it is to teach and how to change to inform the teacher to change their teaching to meet the needs of that child. And that's the role of any assessment, and it's not just the test at the end of the year. It's too late. By the end of the year, you give a standardized test score and find out what the child knows. Well, it's too late for the teacher to help the child learn. There has to be an ongoing system of assessment way before you get to a standardized test in order to really get to a goal of all kids achieving. And so I think you'd have to look at any assessment in terms of its goal. And if the goal is to assess what that child knows to inform the teacher about what to teach, that's got to be an ongoing process. And whether it's, no matter what kind of test it is. And if you think about what you normally do, I mean, you need to align your grading systems to that. We used to have the old ABCD grading system. Ultimately, you have to align your report cards to parents along the notions of standards in order to give a proper indication to parents about where that child is with respect to standards. And an A or a B doesn't necessarily tell them that, because you might have things mixed in an A or a B that relate to effort as much as to achievement. And you have to separate, you know, is this child making an effort from the question of does this child know? Because you can have children that are making efforts but still aren't learning, and you need to be able to communicate that. So you need to align the whole system along standards lines if you're really going to get every child to achieve. And, you know, portfolios could become or not become a part of that, but ultimately they have to be aligned with that. And I don't know that schools, I mean, we're still learning all of this stuff. We're still learning how to do this, and we're not necessarily as efficient at it as we ought to be.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I guess, simplicity in how I'm looking at this, but I think what you described makes a lot of sense, and could aid the teacher and aid the student both. But when we're talking about the student still participating in the same school year with the same teacher, it seems like all the assignments could just go in a manila folder, and as long as the teacher is tracking them, can still do that. And so I'm still having a little difficulty seeing the value of the portfolio itself to that process. And I guess I'm not hearing anything from either of you say, yeah, the portfolio is the best way to do it, but just that it's the one you've been handed.
Well, I think it's, I stated earlier that I believe the portfolio represents a best practice. And the term portfolio is just a collection of evidence. It's a collection of evidence of, in this case, some teachers would use it so that they would put every writing sample in. Some would only put the best practice piece in, or the, let me say, not best practice, but the best piece. So the best expository piece, the best narrative piece, and the best persuasive piece. That stays in the portfolio. That's a record of evidence. We have to have that in order to issue the SIM. We feel that we have to have those pieces there. We also have the piece that's graded by the state. And so we have that piece also to factor in to show what the student's progress is in writing. And for me, that's the basic use of a portfolio. I did a dissertation on portfolios. I could tell you many different ways in which portfolios might be used by a teacher, but I wouldn't want to say that that's always the case. I think that you see that people use them in a variety of different ways, and that's how we use them, is to collect the evidence that the student has that quality of writing, and that's what we would issue a SIM or not issue a SIM based upon.
Okay. Well, it looks like we're out of time, and I wish we had more time. I appreciate it very much, Jerry. You're driving down from Hermiston, or driving west from Hermiston. And it's nice to see you again, Jim, and to hear from you. And Elaine made many positive comments about the presentation to revenue, and I would concur. So it's not often Elaine and I agree. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, I'm really pleased that we were able to have you down.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Could I just do one thing?
Sure.
We do have a new chief academic officer at Portland Public Schools, and she's here, Dr. Patricia Pickles from North Chicago, Illinois, and I'd just like to introduce her, and you may see her at some future time, and at least you'll know who she is. So.
Thanks for doing it.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. With
the
that, Ben, join the meeting.